Amen. Last week in our introduction, we just defined what anthropology is. Very simply, who can tell me what it is? What's the definition of anthropology? Study of man. Very simple. Maybe another sentence or two, if you expounded on that a little bit. Study of man, what constitutes a human, and in particular, theologically speaking, we want to talk a little bit about what God's intention was for creating man. And that's really what we talked about last week. Why? Why humans? And we posited a few answers, and we didn't really nail anything down. And if you're new to theology, get acquainted with that frustration. We sometimes ask more questions than we answer. But all that's the pursuit of a better understanding. So tonight, we're going to assume we've understood that we're studying the nature of humans as God intended them. And we want to talk about now what exactly did He create when He created a human. And as I said, historically, Christians have had a variety of positions. And you come here tonight, I suspect, with differing positions on what exactly God did create. Here's a little outline that we're going to cover here in the next couple of weeks, actually. Tonight, we're going to talk about the constitution of man, part one, monism. Now, let's start right here with a definition, or at least some kind of understanding. What do we mean by constitution? Makeup, the essential parts, we might say. What constitutes a chair? Well, it would depend on the chair. So we might say, what constitutes this chair? And then you would say, well, it's got fabric and four legs and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what we're talking about. How is a man, or what is a man made up of? And so we're going to start with monism tonight. And then we'll look at next week the constitution of man, another version of that, which is dualism. And then we'll talk about the creation of the human soul. Now, we can't start there because that presumes that we have a soul. And that's getting ahead of ourselves because we haven't made that determination yet. All right. So let's start tonight with the constitution of man, monism. Also, we're going to study the image of God in man, but now we're getting way ahead of ourselves. Questions that we're really trying to get at. What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be human? Maybe I could say it this way. What makes us different? You've all studied the book of Genesis, probably the beginnings. And God created all these things, and some of these things He created were crawly, creepy things, and things that swim along the ground, and things that swim in the sea, and animals, and birds, and four-footed animals, and web-footed animals. What makes humans different? What does it mean to be a human? What would you say? What makes us different? Okay, the image of God would be a wonderful kind of capsule around what makes us different. Is that the only thing that makes us different? Or maybe said another way, what about that makes us different? What does it mean to carry the image of God? We have His character. Okay, so are we born with God's character? Communicable attributes. Now, that's two big words. There are aspects or attributes of God that He communicates to humans, shares with humans. And so some of those characters of God, we're able to manifest. Give me an example of a communicable attribute of God that we possess. The ability to love. All right, now let's go back to our question. Do, like, Papa Bears and Mama Bears love each other? Have you ever thought about that? Do they have the capacity to love? Did God share any of His communicable attributes with other creatures? Okay. Couldn't know unless you could ask one. How do we define love? How do you know that a man and a woman love one another? Do you have to ask them? Okay. So don't we kind of press this issue of love? We're just picking on that a little bit, that it's not what you say, but it's what you do. And so maybe we don't have to ask the bear. Maybe we could watch the bears. Would we see love between mama bears and papa bears? Now, I'm not really looking for an answer. This is just a way to kind of get you to think about things in a different way, maybe. At the end of the day, we want to try to realize what does it mean to be a human, not what does it mean to be a bear. So that's not really where we're headed. And we'll move on to the next one. When you die, what happens to you? When you die, what happens to you? So if you put those together, what does it mean to be you? And then when you die, what happens to you? And now again, we could bring the bears in, right? Does something happen to you when you die that doesn't happen to a bear when it dies? And inevitably, you need to answer that question, not so much because you're concerned about the bear, but because you are concerned about a right understanding of what happens to you and whether or not a part of what happens to you when you die is, in fact, what defines you as a human. And I think you'll learn that it does. Is there such a thing as a soul? So if we go back to the previous question, what happens when you die? What do you think happens when you die? What happens to you? Come on, you got an answer. What happens to you when you die? Your soul leaves your body. Okay, so what happens to you? What about your body? So it's not you. Okay, did you hear her answer? What happens to you? All right, and your soul goes on somewhere. So press that a little bit. Where does it go? Well, it depends on some of the choices you made or whatever theological paradigm you want to apply. Some are going to go to heaven and some are going to go to hell. Well, then what happened to your body? And her answer was, it turns to dust. And so my question, was that you? And we seem to be left with only one answer. It's not me. Why not? Because I'm not there. Have you ever stood over the grave of one of your loved ones? Maybe with someone else who loved them, not more than you, but is grieving differently than you, and you're trying to comfort them. What's one of the things we just tend to say? They're not there. Where are they? Gone to be in the presence of the Lord. Okay? Everybody comfortable with that counsel? Well, that's what we're thinking about tonight. Is that good counsel? Are they actually not there? All right? And a part of that means we believe, where there seems to be a fairly common acceptance here tonight, that we have a soul. And I could get us ahead of ourselves and say, then is that you? Because that's the us that we say isn't here anymore. So that must be who we are. We're a soul. Are we not then a body? Are we just a soul living in a borrowed something? Does this thing matter that we're in? Okay, these are the questions we're looking for. What, if any, is the distinction between the soul and the spirit? All right. Say, well, that's not me. That's just dust. I'm in heaven, or Aunt Gertrude's in heaven. Well, what part of her's in heaven? Well, she is. What do you mean by that? Well, her soul is in heaven. Well, then what about her spirit? Where's her spirit? Now you're forced to think about that in a way you haven't before. Say, well, it's there too because the spirit and the soul is the same thing. Some of you believe that. But if you are challenged to think maybe that that's not the case, now you've got three yous that you have to determine which you is you and which part of you is wherever it is. Okay? So these are the things we're trying to answer. They really do have serious implications on your spiritual life as a Christian. What is the relationship then between the body and the soul? Okay, we believe we have a soul, and we're just kind of tracking with this one that it's really who we are, and it's not there anymore when we die. What relationship did it have with the body? Is the body just a carrier? Does it not matter? Or maybe let me ask it this way. What future relationship does your soul have with your dusty body? Any future relationship? Okay, it does. How come? In what way does it have a future relationship? Present relationship is at least that the soul is being occupied or occupies the body. We'll just be simple there. Now we've died and we're imagining there's some separation between those two. So that relationship is over. So now there's a new relationship, dust and living soul. Is there a future relationship with that body? Okay, what's that relationship look like? Pardon me? A glorified body. Is it that body? In a glorified state. So was that you all along? Are there more than one you? All right. So what is our essential nature? Okay, these, I don't want to assume these terms. We're talking about, naturally speaking, what is the essence of who we are? What's the essential nature of water? Mike Troyer is the only one qualified to answer. Just that simple? Okay, equal parts of hydrogen and oxygen?
Two parts of hydrogen, one part of
oxygen is the essential nature of water, which in my neighborhood you can no longer safely drink. What happens to the essential nature of my water when I boil it? Okay, so then I'm left with nothing to drink. Yeah, so, but we understand what essential, what we mean by this now. Okay, what's the essential nature of a human? This is our current question. Let's talk about it. Well, the words that the Bible uses with reference to the constitution of man are really incredibly varied, and they make a whole spectrum of suggestions. Let's look at them. You've got this table, but here it is right up here. Now, the middle down here is Greek. That's kind of turned into English words that you can recognize. But here's the heart of it. So the Bible calls the human a body. The Bible speaks of us having a soul. The Bible speaks of us having a spirit. The Bible speaks of us having a mind and a heart. And that heart is not the organ. Flesh, gut, and bowels. And again, when you get down to the heart, flesh, gut, and bowels, it's not talking about the natural form of that, but more of the essence of what it means to be a human. And you're getting into some emotional kind of context, more of what we feel, more closely to our personality. But the Bible uses all of those terms in one way or another in all of these texts, and we could have put dozens more, to speak of what it means to be a human. We have these kind of things going on in our constitution. All right. So that's just kind of get you thinking there that there's really lots of different words, and maybe we need to work a little harder to understand it. Well, there are two main alternatives, two main answers that you as a Christian are allowed to kind of considering in the consideration of our essential nature, what we're made up of. Physicalism, dualism. Physicalism meaning we are material only. We are flesh, if I could use that word. And in this class, all those words start to get redefined. But you're with me so far if I say that's what that means. It's the material part. Or you believe in dualism. And that is that we have more than one part, at least two parts, which one would be physical, the other would be... What'd you say, John? Did you say something? Spiritual. Or one would be material and the other would be immaterial. Okay. Now, if you break those down into two categories, you have to then break those down into categories. In the physicalism category, the first option is naturalism. And that is that we are simple, of dust, earthy creatures. That's naturalism, that there is no spiritual element to our being. And that is fundamentally not Christian, and we won't consider it the rest of the class, because this is a consideration of Christian anthropology. A naturalist perspective of what it means to be a human is not Christian. And so it is under the branch of physicalism, but it's not Christian. The other is monism. And I said physicalism talks about a material part only, but really what we're talking about is one part only. And to what degree you might ascribe or not ascribe a spiritual aspect to that, it's still only one part. And so if we backed up to the introduction where we kind of got our mind thinking and we say, where is Aunt Gertrude? She died like 4 years ago. The answer is dust, right? That's just the answer. She's just dust because she was just one thing. And you can go back to the grave and look at that one thing and that's all that's there. There is not another part of her that we have to wonder where that part of her is. The other option is dualism, and there you have two options, at least in Christian orthodoxy. Trichotomy, meaning that there are parts, and how many parts are there? Three parts, and ordinarily, those three parts are body, soul, spirit. Body, soul, spirit. The body is this part that's going to become dust. The Spirit is ordinarily, at least in Christian orthodoxy, what we mean when we talk about the spiritual part of us that goes to be in the presence of the Lord. The soul is what we might often refer to as the personality. It's where our memories are. It's our mind. Sometimes that word's used for it. Okay. But soul and spirit, even as we go through these the next 3 weeks, they get swapped around. Even in the Bible, they get swapped around. It's one of the reasons why this aspect of anthropology is very difficult to be really dogmatic about. But that's one option. Three parts: body, soul, spirit. There's another option, and that's dichotomy. Two parts: body and soul or spirit, whichever name you want to apply to it. Body and soul or spirit. Okay? So those are your options. This is not a Christian option. We got to talk about all three of those. Tonight we're going to talk about that one. Everybody's with us? Okay. So let's talk about that one. Views held by Christians: monism, dualism, trichotomy, dichotomy. So here's the question. Is our body the same as our soul? Meaning, do we believe in monism? Okay? That's our question. Anybody want to say yes or no? Or can we ask again at the end of the class? Yes or no? Are there any monists in here that have considered anthropological think and believe that they're a monist? None? How many of you know what you believe about anthropology of these options? So less than half of you. So we could have a secret monist in here, because apparently we got a secret lots of other things in here, so one of them could be a monist, right? So here's the question. Is our body the same as our soul? And really, this is what we're asking. Are you a monist? Do you believe that men, humans, are one thing? Well, here's the definition of monism. It comes from the Greek word monos, and you recognize that, right? It simply means one or alone. It is the teaching that the spirit, soul, and body are all essentially the same, or that the spirit and soul do not exist without the body. Regarding death, this often goes by the name soul sleep. Or if you ask them, a monist, what happens to the body or soul, because they're just one, at death, their answer would be they sleep. Why would that be the answer? Well, first of all, it assumes they're Christian. And what they're simply saying is, when you died, you died. All of you died, and all of you was buried, and all of you is now waiting for something. What are you waiting for? The resurrection. And what's happening between then and that is nothing. You're just sleeping in the ground. And that's called soul sleep. The reason it's called soul sleep instead of just, well, you're asleep or you're just dead, is because it assumes a Christian perspective. That there's a soul there, but it's not a part of your body. It is who you are. All right. Who believes that? Well, Jehovah's Witnesses believe that. Now, Jehovah's Witnesses would be hard to peg as monists. It's not a term they would, even in their theological writings, acknowledge. What they do acknowledge is soul sleep, which makes them monists. In other words, they're saying there is never a separation, and therefore we are one. And they do believe that when you die, you are sleeping until the resurrection. Christian Scientists believe the same thing, if you can actually say they believe anything, because it doesn't get any more confusing than that, because they're not Christian or scientific. And so their name is a real misnomer. Christadelphians, you've probably never heard of. J.A.T. Robertson. Those in the neo-Orthodox camp, let me give you a name you might know if you've studied some Christian history or philosophy. Karl Barth taught soul sleep and therefore defended a monist position. Okay? So that's what we're talking about. You are just you. And when you die, you die. And you go to dust. And if you're a Christian, your only hope is what? A resurrection where you, all of you, will be resurrected. King Henry VI was a monist. The souls that do depart hence do sleep, being without all sense, feeling, and perceiving until the day of judgment, do utterly dissent from the right that is closed to us in Holy Scriptures. You're just dead. Or, as a Christian, you're asleep. So in other words, if we look at this, and we'll be working with this throughout the next couple of weeks, these are our options at death, and we're right here. It's just you. It's your body. And we don't disregard that a part of what it means to be you is spiritual, but we can't divide that into its pieces. And so you just died. Got that? These others are just blank because we'll come to them later. All right, let's defend it. Let's see if you are that. And if you're not sure what you are, we might even convince you tonight that you're a monist. Okay, that's going to be my goal. I'm going to wear my go monism hat and let's see if we can convince you. Number one, when the Bible speaks of death, it speaks in terms of sleeping. Now, again, we're going from what it means to be a human to what it happens to a human when they die, because that's really what unlocks what you actually believed about it when you were alive. Well, that's why all this talk of death. And in the Bible, when it speaks of death, it speaks in terms of sleeping. Now, that's probably not new to you, but in case it is, let's look at it. 1 Thessalonians. Paul writes, "But we do not want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, so that you'll not grieve as do the rest who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will not precede those who have fallen," what? Asleep. Now, it helps to look at Scripture and always try to think about what's the context. And so let's get the context of this. Why is Paul writing this to those Christians in Thessalonica? Well, the reason is clear if you read the book of 1 Thessalonians around chapter 4, is that they've been Christians long enough now and under trouble long enough now that some of them have died. And they're wondering what happened to them. And so they're asking Paul, tell us what happened to them. And what does he say? What does he say? They're asleep. What else does he say? Nothing. They're asleep. So imagine that he was actually in Thessalonica. And imagine it was your Aunt Gertrude. And you just can't get over it because you were, after all, so close. And you are grieving because you don't know what's going to happen to her. And unlike us, Paul does not say, she's not there. He does not say, look, her soul is in heaven. He does not even say that she had parts and that one day they'll be reunited in a glorified body. He just simply says what? They're asleep. So the monist would say, see, even the Apostle Paul doesn't make any reach to try to defend that we have parts. It doesn't make any sense. And if it made sense, the time when we use it most often at grieving to talk about where we are, he's not compelled to do that whatsoever. Now, he does in chapter 5 take up the task of saying there is going to be a resurrection and that those who fell asleep before you, don't worry about them. They will be resurrected. He doesn't say you don't have to worry about them because they're going to get their body back. And in the meantime, they're in heaven dancing with Jesus. The kind of things we like to say at funerals. He doesn't say any of that. They're asleep. They will be resurrected. Let this be your comfort. All right. So he's defending. At least I'm suggesting he's defending with my go monism hat on. Monism. That we're just one thing. You don't like him now?
Well,
no, I'm just kidding. Go ahead. Yes. Yes. And you're not really ahead of us, but you're going to a text we won't go to. But the monist who believes we're just asleep is then confronted with the dualist who says, but Paul clearly says to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. The monist defense, which is what your professor was articulating, is a time-space defense, not an anthropological defense. They teach that, well, what happens is it's the same thing as when you went into surgery. Right? You went into surgery. Do you remember what happened before you woke up? Well, nothing. It was an instant, right? I went to sleep and I woke up and now, you know, they took out my liver or whatever. You have no recollection of that. And that's the argument the monist makes, is that as far as you are concerned, as soon as you were absent, you were present. And the absent from the body aspect would simply mean from that body of dust. And now you're present with the Lord and it happens just like that. So you aren't ahead of us. That's how the monist replies to the objector, who is the dualist, who says, no, Paul says the absent from the body is present with the Lord, so there must be two parts. So he may have been a monist if he was defending that position. But are we together here so far? We can't take this long in every text. We got lots of scripture. But this was an important one because he is addressing the very issue we're considering. What happens to somebody when they die? And his answer seems to be very clear. Argument number two from the monism camp. Those in the Old Testament showed no sign of a belief in an intermediate state. You can't find it, I would say to you, in your Old Testament. They simply spoke of going to the place where all the dead go, which is the grave, which is most commonly called Sheol. Their hope, their only hope, was in the resurrection. They didn't place any present hope in a present presence with the Lord. So let's look at a few of those Old Testament texts that show that they had no concept of an intermediate state. Now, that's the first time I've used that word. What we're talking about is exactly what Rebecca just mentioned, and that is there is the state of life, there is the state of death, and we're, as Christians, believing there's the state of the resurrection. What's the intermediate state between death and the resurrection? And we're going to argue that the Old Testament saints didn't have any concept of an intermediate state. In the book of Job, for instance, if I look for Sheol as my home, I make my bed in the darkness. If I call to the pit, you are my father, to the worm, my mother and my sister. Where now is my hope? And who regards my hope? Will it go down with me to Sheol? Shall we together go down into the dust? This is not a text I ordinarily choose for a funeral, because there's just not a lot of hope there, right? I'm just dead. And it doesn't do me any good to think about my dad or my mom or my sisters. It doesn't do me any good to even regard the notion of hope, because I'm just dead. Because that's what happens when you die. If we look at Genesis chapter 50, then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. Well, we studied that. Why? Now, in the context of tonight's discussion, what's Joseph concerned about? Well, let me just go so far as to say he's concerned about him. Well, what him is he concerned about? The him after he dies. And he says, don't leave me here. Don't leave me here. Take me, and all that by that time he imagines will be left of him is his bones. Take my bones to the promised land. Why? Why? Why does Joseph want to go to the promised land? Why did Abraham insist on being buried in the promised land? Isaac in the promised land. Why? A sign of faith. Faith in what? The hope of a resurrection. They believed in the resurrection, and they believed that God would inevitably somehow, albeit mysteriously to them, fulfill his promises made. And that promise included, Craig challenged us even this morning, it included land. And you know what? If it's going to happen there, I want to be there when it happens. But you're dead. Yeah, but I can still be there. How? Take my body there, and I'll be there. Do you hear the argument? That's what the monist would tell you. Joseph had no thought of being separated from his body. He had every thought of being resurrected from the dead, even if it was nothing but bones. If we go to argument number three, many biblical writers explicitly say that there's no intermediate state. First of all, we would suggest the Old Testament saints had no concept of it. And further than that, we would say they argued against it. The psalmist in Psalm chapter 6, verse 5 says, for there is no mention of you in death, God, in Sheol, who will give you thanks? There's nothing going on when I die. And there's nothing about me being in your presence, because I couldn't mention you. I couldn't give you thanks. And again, what do we do with the dead? Well, they're not here. They're there. What are they doing there? Well, they're making mention of God, and they are rejoicing and worshiping with God. And that never crossed David's mind. There's none of that stuff happening when I'm dead. I'm just in the grave. In chapter 30, verse 9, what profit is there in my blood if I go down to the pit? Will the dust praise you? Will it declare your faithfulness? Because that's all I'm going to be is dust. So do you see, they're arguing against any idea or notion of an intermediate state. They're just dead. And when they're dead, they're dust. And if they had real, genuine faith, that faith rests just like in massive quantities. That hope rested in massive quantities in one thing. And that was a resurrection. It had no hope in what might happen between then and then, between now and then. Their only hope was one day, in some mysterious way, this dust might rise from the dead. And only then could it praise you. In the meantime, I'm not hearing any singing. Psalm chapter 88. For my soul has had enough troubles, and my life is drawn near to Sheol. I am reckoned among those who go down to the pit. Now stop right here. This is the classic Christian monist position. Don't imagine they don't think we have a soul. They just say they're inseparable parts. You can't divide them up. And at death, there's no division. And so here, the psalmist acknowledges a soul and a physical life that is now drawing near to the grave. But isn't imagine or would not even suggest that they're separated. Now he just imagines he'll be reckoned among those who go down to the pit. I've become like a man without strength, forsaken among the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more. And they are cut off from your hand. Now you either have to believe that he's thinking there only of those that are lost without hope and therefore cut off from God, or you would have to agree with me as a monist that he does not believe that there's any separation of the body and the soul and that it's just dead and that there's not any present bliss in some imagined paradise. His only hope, and it's in some sense a hope against hope because he's humble enough to admit he's not worthy, but yet his only hope, if there is any, would be in a resurrection when he, all of him, would rise from the dead. In Isaiah 38:18, for Sheol cannot thank you. Death cannot praise you. Those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your faithfulness. And again, this isn't a hopeless reality with no hope of a resurrection, but this is if I have any hope, then it has to be garnered by my faith. And if I have any faith, I have to execute that faith while I'm alive. There's no hope for me after I die to then become faithful. Because when you die, there's no faithfulness. There's no praising. There's just dust. Are you convinced yet? Any closet monists now ready to come out of the closet? Okay, these are pretty compelling arguments. If you have any respect for appreciation of the Old Testament, which we just studied last semester, and I think you agreed with me that it is the very Word of God. So these aren't the ramblings of some misguided prophets. These are God's words. Ecclesiastes. Now here we need to at least include the possibility of being misguided. If you understand Solomon and the state of his mind when he writes Ecclesiastes, that doesn't mean it was absent or void of any truth. You just have to be careful what it is he's expressing. Well, here's what he's expressing. For the living know they will die, but the dead don't know anything. Nor have they any longer a reward, for their memory is forgotten. He's not saying everybody forgets about them. He says they forget about everything. There's no indication here of a vitality separated from a physical body that is enjoying some wonderful thing with the hope that they'd one day be glorified, which is what Christie suggested is going to happen. Not according to Solomon. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For there is no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you are going. What is there in the grave? Just dust. That's it. Well, what is that dust? It's you. What part of me? And at that point, they're looking at you like you're a nut. Part of you? It's just you. And you're dust. Argument number 4. The idea of an intermediate state, I would suggest to you, is simply a Greek idea. It shares more with Greek mythology than it does with biblical revelation. The Hebrews believed in a holistic self, one, in which the hope was in the resurrection. The Greeks downplayed the role of the body and the material self. It was evil. It was decrepit. They believed that death was a release from this confinement. Those who see a plurality in the constitution of human nature read the Bible, therefore, through Greek eyes. That's your problem. You've got Greek eyes. Failing to see that when the Bible speaks of the body, soul, and spirit, it's really talking about the same as when it speaks of the mind, heart, and soul. In other words, it's just another way of talking about you. And even though there are nuances there and facets to a diamond, it's still just a diamond, isn't it? Those facets, if you break them into pieces, well, they're still a diamond, I guess, but they're not worth anything. And they're saying here, you got this convoluted idea from the Greeks. You didn't get it from the Hebrew God. You certainly didn't get it from the Hebrew people. Now, notice here this idea of how do you divide the mind, the heart, and the soul? Because the Bible speaks of your mind. The Bible speaks of your heart. The Bible speaks of your soul. And in all those cases, it's talking about your personality, your emotions, your passions. And we would say you can't divide that because those are all the same thing. It's just three ways of saying the same thing. Well, they would say, well, then you get it now. Because when the Bible says body, soul, and spirit, it's just three ways to say the same thing. It's not three things. It's not three parts. See with this argument? You're just too Greek. That's the issue. You're not Hebrew enough. Argument number five. I'm going to be sure I keep up in my notes. Modern science. Watch this one carefully. Modern science has demonstrated that there is a one-to-one correspondence between the neurological activity of the brain and the feelings, memories, personalities, and attitudes of a person, which we might call their soul. This makes the existence of the soul or spirit not only unnecessary, but it's an untenable argument. Once the brain ceases activity, the person ceases to exist. Now, the first thing you might want to do is say that's bad science. I would say to you it's not bad science, but you need to understand exactly what's being said here. What's being said here is that we do now know scientifically that there are parts of your brain that can be damaged, physiologically damaged, altered, removed by surgery, for instance. And what goes with it? You go with it. The part of you that we knew. One of our dear brothers, Richard Blink, had a brain tumor, had portions of it removed. And many of you, with genuine compassion but obvious observation, would say a part of Richard was gone. His personality was altered. The argument here is, see, you can't separate the soul from the brain. It's a part of the brain. It's a material thing. And while there's some mystery to it, this proves that if the brain stops to cease completely, you don't just lose a part of you. You lose what? You. You're not there anymore. Now, Christians get that argument and they don't think that they're confronting some anthropological dilemma when they say, what do we do with this individual who is, what's the phrase? Brain dead. What do we do? What's the ethical thing to do? Well, there's argument about what the ethical thing to do is, but it's never an argument about the anthropology of a human. It's about the compassion of a human that now is not. That's the ethical argument. They now are not. So do you see? Do you see my argument here? It's a silly thing to suggest that there's some part of you that isn't you. And where most of you resides is in the brain. And we can prove it to you. We just take your brain out. No, but you know, science is saying you've got to think about this thing. William Rowe writes in The Philosophy of Religion and Introduction, the evidence that we have indicates that our mental life is dependent on certain bodily processes, particularly those associated with the brain. We know, for example, that damage to various parts of the brain results in the cessation of certain kinds of conscious states, memories, thought processes, and the like. It seems eminently reasonable to infer from this that consciousness is dependent for its existence on the existence and proper function of the human brain. When at death, the brain ceases to function, then the reasonable inference is that our mental life, our soul life ceases as well. What do you think about that? Who's got the notebook? You got the actual notebook. Look to the questions, if you would, and find question number 4 and read it out loud, somebody. I want to be sure I got the right question. You looking at it? Wow, how do you see that? You've got like amazing eyes. You are an anthropological specimen. That's not the right question. Yeah, questions. Oh, here we go. All right, here we go. Listen, number 4. May I borrow this a moment? Can you read it for me? Do you believe that outbursts of anger, listen, do you believe that outbursts of anger produced by irritability are sinful? Like this guy right here gets on my nerves. Right? And he just pushes my button. You say those kind of things. He irritates me. And occasionally, I won't take it. And I get angry. And I get violently angry. Bruised. He's bruised. Do you think that's sinful? Yes, thank you. It is sinful for me to act that way. All right. Well, modern science has advanced to the point that a pill can affect the chemical reactions in the brain that will reduce my irritability. And he just cannot bug me anymore. You with me? This then necessarily results in reducing what? My anger. It reduces my anger. In this sense, then, it seems to be true that sin can be controlled to a certain degree by medication. Do you agree with that? This is, you know, I don't know, it was like Letterman when he first began his show. He's gone now. But some of us are old enough to remember when he started. He used to have that segment in his show, that's things that make you go, right? This is one of those things, isn't it? So is it possible that medication can reduce the practice of sin? All right. If we go to the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus says, you have heard it said that if you commit adultery, it's a sin. But I tell you, if you lust after a woman in your heart, you've also sinned, right? Okay. So is there no difference between the sins of the heart and the actions that we take? Are they the same? Is that what he was saying? They're the same. So, in other words, I'm no longer guilty of anger against Brent. What am I guilty of? Murdering him? Now understand, what Jesus was teaching there was not that they're all the same. What he was saying is you've not liberated yourself from all the sin in it, but you cannot kill the guy. And that is different than being angry with the guy. Now let's go back to my question again. And you're right, I did rephrase it. But is it possible that a pill can limit sinful behavior? It seems possible, doesn't it? That doesn't change my heart. I'm not asking you that. But can it limit sinful behavior? Why? Who's sinning? Who's sinning? Who's sinning when he can't take any more, Brent? And I'm not the only one, by the way. He gets on Michael's nerves, too. Who's sinning? I am. What part of me is? My brain? Now, see, this has huge ramifications. Do you follow me? We're not talking about how you get saved or the human heart yet. We're just talking about just getting angry. And that now we seem to have advanced to the point, I'm not arguing for meds or anything. I'm just saying we seem to have advanced to the point that my case is a good case. And that is that you cannot separate me from my brain. And yes, if you affect my brain, you affect me, not a part of me, me, who I am, even as a sinner. So now you have a new counseling tool, right? Sure you do. Would the world figure this out, right? A long time ago. That's why no one wants to go to a pastor for counseling. Why? Because I can't write a prescription. And I don't say that with mockery. I simply say because I can't fix it. You see what they're arguing for? You could ask them what your anthropological conviction is. I don't have any idea what you're talking about. I just want a pill. Well, you do have a conviction. And it's leading you to this conclusion. And you believe you are one. And that the behavior that you're guilty of has a physical element, and it's your brain. And now there's a pill to solve all of that. And taken to its logical conclusion with just enough time and just enough science, guess what? We don't need anymore. We don't need God anymore. We certainly don't need a Savior. We just need better pills. We just need better doctors. So understand some of these things that you see in the cultural arena, these are anthropological issues, and you can't resolve them ethically until you resolve them anthropologically. Till you understand and have an inviolable conviction about what it means to be a human, don't be offering solutions for human problems. See how silly that is? I mean, if I don't have any idea what a dog is, I shouldn't be a vet. I need to understand a dog to be a vet. And we need to be careful in our cultural exchanges. Oftentimes what happens here is we enter into those arenas with our moral convictions, not undergirded with any theological certainties. And the world does what to us as Christians? They make fun of us. You know why? Because we should be made fun of. Because we don't make good arguments. Because we don't understand. All right, so that's what we're talking about. That's just my little deviation. It's question four. These are great questions, by the way. Go to Starbucks with somebody like this week and say, you know, can you remember what Steve said? Well, not much of it, but the questions will bring it back to your mind and you'll understand what we're dealing with here. Well, let's respond to this argument, okay? That's my pro-monism speech. Let's dismantle it if we can. The first, now these correlate to the arguments, and I'm not even going to remember what the arguments, they should be kind of self-evident. But here was argument number one. Sleep is a metaphor that's often used for death. This does not mean that the whole person is asleep. It's just that the body is asleep. So I would simply say, yes, the Bible often speaks of sleeping, but it's just another way of speaking of dying. And it's metaphorically used, but more than that, it's allegorically used. It's used to prove something that's not evident. So what is it proving? That I'm not really dead. Paul's not making an anthropological argument. He's making a much more profound theological argument. And that is that the believer doesn't die. He just passes from one life to another. But the body does die. And the body then is best called what? Asleep. Because it's going to need to be awakened one day by the quickening power of God and glorified so that it can once again fit you for all eternity. So that's my response. How's that? Pretty good? Yeah, it's pretty weak, actually. But it's the best response we have to that. And most of you think it's adequate because most of you just assumed all along a dualist position. You never really thought about it. That's what you were taught if you've been raised in church. And that every time you read sleep, he's talking about death. But do you ever read sleep about an unbeliever? Is an unbeliever in the Bible ever said to be asleep? No. They're dead. Both words are used regularly in the New Testament, and asleep is only ever used as it regards believers. And I would then strengthen my argument by saying Paul had a particular perspective in view and was making a particular point way more than just dying. But the faith of a believer, the certainty of a resurrection, and the fact that they never really died. That's the point he's making. Okay, so that's my response. Number two. Monism is a misunderstanding in the nature of progressive revelation. In other words, the Old Testament saints didn't have as much revelation as we do. Now, let's stop right there. If you haven't been in the earlier parts of theology, you don't have any idea what we're talking about. But what we're talking about is that Abraham didn't get it like Paul got it. Because Abraham didn't have as much revelation as Paul had. Abraham didn't even know the word Jesus. Right? No. I mean, did David know about a cross? No. All right, so the God has been, since the beginning, revealing himself and his plan of redemption for humankind, and we call that progressive revelation. And from Genesis to Revelation, he is progressively revealing truth so that the best, we might just make a simple argument, the most articulate and theologically developed New Testament believer was John. On the Isle of Patmos, the last living apostle. He had direct revelation from God, and he had more revelation than any other living apostle or prophet of God ever had, because he had the accumulated revelation of all those prophets. So just that's what we mean by progressive revelation. So now let's go back to the Old Testament saints who had no concept, we would say, of a divided body and soul. And we would say, well, no, that doesn't mean it's not true. They had no concept of Jesus being born in a manger either. Right? No. They had no clue. There were clues, but they had no clue. Therefore, while it is true that they had very little knowledge of an intermediate state, this doesn't rule out the possibility of its existence any more than perhaps you, having no knowledge of what a new heaven and a new earth is, rules out the possibility that it will actually one day exist. Because we believe it will one day exist, but you don't have any knowledge of it, and you don't really have any concept of it. Other than what limited part of it the Bible tells us about. So number three, while knowledge of the intermediate state was obscure in the Old Testament, these biblical writers do not say there is no intermediate state. You see, I said that they argued there was not one. All I really argued was that they don't seem to have a concept of one. But again, that doesn't mean there isn't one. Their message is about what people cannot do in the intermediate state. The basic message is that after we die, we cannot, watch this, proclaim knowledge, wisdom, and praise to others on the earth about what the Lord has done. It doesn't mean we can't praise God. It means I can't praise God in a way that will benefit you because I'm not here anymore. That's the argument that we make. And these are serious arguments. These aren't lighthearted, just slough it off. But these are lots of papers written over lots of years, over lots of generations of Christendom that have said this is what why we are not monist, even though the Old Testament saints appeared to be. While it may be true that our ideas of the intermediate state could have Greek influence, that was the next argument, you're just too Greek, it is not true that this makes it wrong. This is committing the genetic fallacy, that's a debate term, of ascribing falsehood to an idea because of its source. In other words, just because it is a Greek idea that there is a body and soul does not mean that it's a bad idea, because the Greeks weren't wrong about everything. The Greeks also believed in a God. Does that mean that we shouldn't believe in a God because it's too Greek? See, that's what we mean by a genetic fallacy. That's a bad argument to say you're too Greek. Besides this, the New Testament is the primary source of our view, we would say, if we're dualists. The Greek philosophy isn't where we get our moorings from. How many of you ever read Plato? A few of you. We'll pray for you. But you didn't have to go to Plato to get a dualist perspective. If you have one, you can get that out of your New Testament. That's the point that's being made here. Don't make it a Greek thing. We would say it's a New Testament thing. It's what the Bible teaches in the New Testament. Number five, while it is true that the brain is intricately linked to all aspects of a whole person, this does not prove that it is the whole person. This is where we went to the brain and the medicine. Okay, so let's watch this. Let's start over. While it is true that the brain is intricately linked to all aspects of a whole person, we won't argue against that. We're going to have to think about it much more carefully as we advance forward into trichotomy and dichotomy. We're not going to argue against it. But that does not prove that it is me. So let me say it that way. While the brain is intricately related to what it means to be me, that does not mean it is me. The body is a part of what a person is, and a part of that body is the brain. But this does not necessarily mean that it is all that a person is. All right? So here's what we're saying to the monist who says, see, your brain is you. We're saying, my brain is so intricately a part of me that it may be very difficult to separate the two, but that does not prove the argument that you're making, and that is that it is me. Because I'm going to argue it is not me. One of the ways we argue that it is not me is like this. This is a window that is in a third-story attic where you have been locked away. You are in the attic, and you are you. You with me? You are you in the attic. Your only perspective of the world, your only interaction with the world is through that window. That window becomes cloudy, and your perspective of the world is what? Cloudy. That window becomes broken and shattered, and your perspective, it's the only perspective you have of your world, is what? Broken and shattered. Is that window you? It is not you. But that window could be your brain. And your brain is the vehicle through which you interact in your world. See your world, perceive your world, feel your world, and through which primarily your actions relate you to the world. But that does not mean it's you. It does mean that if it's broken, your interaction with that world, your perception of that world, and its perception of you is affected, but that does not mean it's you. It's just a window. It's just a brain. A very magnificent brain. I mean, I'm not talking about my brain. I'm talking about the brain. Magnificent, right? We'll spend the rest of our human lives trying to delve into it. This is helpful. This is not perfect. We'll tear this window down a couple times before we're done. But it's good enough for tonight. Your brain is not you. You're dismissed.